Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Tennis players have been let out of quarantine today. There have been matches. There have been all sorts of stuff going on over in Australia. We've been up at the crack of dawn to watch all of it. But we're going to leave conversation about it until Monday, when there are about 28 simultaneous tennis events going on all at the same time. And what we're going to do is conclude Australian Open relived, because we've had three wonderful opportunities to talk about Yvonne Goolagong and the 1988 change from Kooyong to Flinders Park, Pat Cash and his sadness at never having won the Australian Open, and then yesterday Pete Sampras's tears of 1995. If you haven't heard any of those, what have you been doing? Go and listen to them. Press pause on this one and go and listen to those. And if you have listened to all of them, well, I think we've got a lovely way to conclude the series with 2017 and dipping into Matt's memories. And the beauty of it is that Matt wasn't on the podcast in 2017. We hadn't had Matt Roberts Day yet. He hadn't become an on-air presence.
He did exist, though.
At least he was alive. Where were you, Matt? What were you doing?
I was living in Madrid. I was on my year abroad at university, living in a tiny box room in a flat in the centre of Madrid. And yeah, this tournament, these 2 weeks are just my happy place. I was teaching English, and because I was in Spain, I had some slightly unusual working hours where I worked from 4 p.m. until 10 p.m. and the rest of the time was for sleeping. I did some of that, and for watching the Australian Open, and I did a lot of that. So yes, this tournament is very fresh in my mind, and I've actually done the research twice for this episode, because the first time I did it, I deleted it all by accident and had to do it all over again.
Yeah, we've had one or two challenges in the making of this podcast, which is currently 2 minutes and 30 seconds old, because Matt had to do his research twice and Catherine was delayed by an hour and a half because of cat vomit, which turns out because of a typo, that was actually car vomit.
Car vomit by a dog, to be clear.
Yes, by a dog.
Yeah.
So that's Billie Jean.
She's an uneasy passenger at the moment.
Yeah, so we feel for Billie Jean, but she's all right now.
Well, she's shivering on my lap, having had a bath to clear up the debris.
Okay.
Right. Oh, and well, that's a drill in the background.
Oh, lovely.
It's all happening. This podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, but well, it kind of fits because Roger Federer's arrival into the 2017 Australian Open was somewhat uncertain and not exactly as planned, and things worked out all right for him, so I'm going to take the positives for the sake of this podcast.
Yes, it's a good draw because we're all in the draw.
Yeah, exactly right. This podcast's going well because we're on it. Now Matt was in Madrid in his box room. Catherine, you and I were both in Australia. I was there for BBC Radio 5 Live. You were there for Eurosport at the time, reporting. And I assume we were doing daily editions of the tennis podcast. I mean, I have no idea how we were doing that without Matt, but I mean, seems like we were.
Yeah, I remember so few of them. I remember. Oh, that's the drill again. I remember you were doing all the editing. I do remember that you were staying up and doing all of the editing after we'd recorded. And it was all I could do just to stay up to record the thing at the end of play. And then you would disappear and stay up all night editing and uploading the thing.
Mm.
And then I think shortly after that, we decided to look for an intern.
Welcome, Matt. But I think that sums it up, really, because maybe I was up all night every day, but it wasn't a problem because that particular tournament was so full of moments, so much adrenaline was running through every day of that draw, so much happening that I can't really remember feeling it being a problem. I was riding on a wave of excitement because it was, I'd say... You know, I mean, I think I've probably been to about 16 or 17 Australian Opens. I think that must be the best one overall, just for completeness of storylines.
It was like 2 weeks full of that day we had at the Australian Open last year where we had to record 2 podcasts. It was like the tournament was sort of caught in its own slipstream and had this additional force behind it that was pulling it along. And... You know, I've certainly been on site and had days at tournaments where it felt like that, where there's this snowballing effect of great match after great match. That one at the Australian Open last year. I remember a day at Queen's a few years ago where all the top 3 seeds followed each other onto centre court and out of the tournament.
David remembers that day less fondly.
Yeah, I'm coming out in a cold sweat just thinking about that.
Andy Murray losing. But... Yeah, the whole tournament was like that. You went into every single day expecting something brilliant and dramatic to happen. And that's such an incredible feeling to have.
I was going through my phone for hashtag content from that fortnight in 2017. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of photos of me just looking like I can't believe my luck. Which will spare you from. But there's also an awful lot of videos of crowds reacting to things in Garden Square, which really age so badly. It's like trying to take a photo of the stars at night, isn't it? Like, you just have to be there and see it with your own eyes. You can't capture it forevermore, certainly not on a phone camera anyway. And yet, I tried to do it on multiple occasions, apparently in January 2017. But because it felt like there were so many moments where I'll need to remember where I was and what it felt like when this thing happened. Usually you're lucky if that's once per tournament that you need to indelibly mark a moment on your brain. Mm. But I probably had four or five awful videos of that genre on my phone.
Spare you from those as well, I think. But I know what you mean. But anyway.
I mean, and they're all the same. It's just loads of people standing around going, oh, or woo, or yay.
I've never understood, you know, why is it when you're at a football match, people seem to be taking more interest in filming something that they could be watching with their own eyes rather than through the camera lens of their phone?
I know, I'm a terrible cliche and I'm ashamed of myself, yeah. I was younger then.
It's right, we've all done it, Catherine. I did the same thing, but I'm just trying to work out why I do it. Anyway, let's move on, because what we're going to do, we're going to leave an indelible mark on your brain with this podcast, I hope, of that tournament. And we're going to do it by handing over to Matt to start us off and take us through, chronologically, through that tournament. I think that's probably the best way to do it, because... That's the best way to bring home how many twists and turns and surprises and big moments there were. So off you go, Matt.
Thank you. Yes. Well, I can confirm that you did do daily podcasts, because I've been back and listened to not quite all of them, but a lot of them, or certainly moments of a lot of them. And Before we really get into the tournament, I just had to start with your draw preview show where you had Simon Briggs on. Don't worry, this is someone else making a fool of themselves. And
excellent.
This clip of Simon is just Simon at his best. I think by reliving this tournament, we're not only reliving the actual tennis, but we're reliving the experience of covering a slam on site. And one of the things you have to do when you're on site at a slam is get Simon Briggs on the podcast. And this is just him at his best. And it, I think, encapsulates both the madness of Simon a little bit. We love Simon. And also the madness of those first few days before a Grand Slam when jet lag is sort of kicking in and everything's a little bit mad. Simon is a little bit all over the place.
Let's speak to Mr. Simon Briggs from The Telegraph, who's been here a few days. And Simon, you should by now be thoroughly over jet lag. How's it going?
Completely the opposite direction to that. No thanks to the Lawn Tennis Association, who decided in their wisdom last night that they were going to announce the departure of Chief Executive Michael Downey at, I think it was 2 p.m. English time, 1 a.m. for all the tennis reporters in Melbourne, and then followed by a conference call at 1:30. And that was kind of the last straw in a week, which has left me extremely tired and emotional. I'm about to take somebody's head off. If you say anything I don't agree with, you're going to get a flamethrower, I can tell you. I need encouragement. I am struggling a bit. I should actually add that as well as being potentially angry during this podcast, I spoke to my news editor in London on the way into this draw this morning. I can't even talk straight, can I? And by accident, I called him darling. Which wasn't actually my intention at all. It was like that moment at school when you call the teacher dad. He's quite a grizzled chap from, you know, north of England. So he either thinks I'm a lovey or I've got a concealed crush on him now.
Simon Briggs, the Telegraph's tennis correspondent there.
Still the Telegraph's tennis correspondent.
Very much so. And still calling his news editor darling, no doubt.
the unexpected gold you find.
Yeah. Oh, Simon, I'd forgotten that one. So that was our draw preview.
Yeah, and I think it's worth saying on this draw preview, so much of the focus is on Andy Murray. He's the world number one. He's just coming off his incredible run at the end of the 2016 season where he'd won 25 matches in a row, clinched world number one in the final match of the season. And of course, he's never won the Australian Open. He's lost in five finals. There's so much talk about this possibly, surely being the time for Andy Murray.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it felt like Andy Murray's time generally, didn't it? Because of that run at the end of the previous year, and he was back with Lendl, he was the Wimbledon champion, he was world number one, he'd beaten Djokovic, he'd got Lendl with him, and they'd gone off and they'd made big claims about what sort of an off season they were going to have, which in hindsight now looks quite jarring, really, doesn't it? Because I think that may have done him some damage. What do you remember about all that, Catherine?
Well, it was the first slam where he'd gone in as the world number one. And worth saying also that Jo Konta went in on a tremendous run of form. She won Sydney the week before, mm-hmm. And she'd teamed up with Wim Fossette in that off season. And I remember doing an interview with Patrick Mouratoglou for Eurosport on the eve of the tournament, and he said that Jo Konta was the person in her half of the draw that Serena Williams was most worried about. So if you'd told me before the tournament, when all of our talk, all of the focus of our coverage, all of our excitement, which was as high as it's ever been for me covering a Grand Slam, that both Andy Murray and Jo Konta would lose, you know, Andy Murray obviously startlingly early, relatively, and Jo Konta okay, a quarterfinal run, but she was being talked about as a potential champion. If you told me that neither would make the semi-finals, I'd have thought this is going to be a total letdown of a Grand Slam. You know, I had really high hopes for that tournament, and obviously they were fulfilled and more, yet in a completely different way to what any of us were anticipating. which is pretty extraordinary, really.
Mm. And I think that's the defining feature of this tournament. It took you to unexpected, exciting places. Just to run through a few more of the key players going into that tournament, Murray had actually lost to Novak Djokovic in the Doha final at the start of that year. Djokovic was in this weird place where he was still getting quite good results, but not actually playing that well. But he'd beaten Murray in a three-hour match in the Doha final, 6-4 in the third. And then there was Federer and Nadal, who had been out at the end of the 2016 season. Federer missed the Olympics. He missed the US Open because of his knee surgery. And he came in to the Australian Open as the 17th seed. And as Catherine's already said, he gave that line, "It's a good draw because I'm in the draw." He was really playing down his expectations, his chances. He sort of said quarterfinals would be a good result for me here. And then you had Nadal, who similarly had been through quite a slump for a couple of years. His form had really dipped. He hadn't won a Grand Slam since the 2014 French Open. He was the ninth seed. He was that kind of his lowest ebb, but still in the top 10. He'd brought Carlos Moya on board, and first tournament of the year, he'd been okay in Brisbane, but he'd lost to Milos Raonic. So expectations were not particularly high of Rafael Nadal either.
Mm. Do you have any idea what we were thinking predictions-wise
would
happen at all? I bet we all said Andy Murray would win, didn't we?
Yeah, you were confident in Andy Murray, but very, very understandably. And actually, you two, I'm going to throw Simon under the bus again here. You two were actually thinking Federer would get to a quarterfinal match with Murray. You were both quite confident that Federer wouldn't be that rusty. He would be able to be okay. He'd played quite well in the Hopman Cup, I think. Nadal, you were a bit more split. Someone used the words, "Alexander Zverev is a future world number one and Grand Slam champion."
Who?
And I think he will beat Nadal. That would be you, Catherine.
Oh, fudge.
Well,
could be true.
Could still happen.
Something to look forward to. What did everybody else say when I made that declaration? Was there nodding? Or did everyone go, "Ooh, that's a bit bold"?
There was general approval of that. Of
there
that
was
comment.
Optimism around him at the time.
Mm.
It was so high.
People did think it was coming. And frankly, all the evidence was that it was, including in this tournament. I mean, this is where he made a bit of a mark, wasn't it? And he backed it up with all sorts of Masters 1000 tournaments. So, you know, it wasn't
everyone
outlandish.
Then had the attitude. I'm trying to mitigate my idiocy, but everyone had the attitude of it's only a matter of time.
Yeah,
for Zverev. It is written. And I think, you know, he had a touch of that attitude as well.
Hmm. And just the sort of symbolic statement about where Federer and Nadal were at the time is that they had opened Nadal's academy together in Mallorca in October, and the plan had been for them to play an exhibition match, but neither of them was in a position to play. Nadal struggling with his wrist, Federer coming back from his knee surgery. That's October 2016. They couldn't even have a little hit and giggle. And here we are in January, and obviously we all know what happened. So I just think that line really sums up how improbable this was.
And what about Serena and Venus at this point?
Yeah, so the women's side, Angelique Kerber is the top seed. She's coming off that incredible 2016, which saw her win two slams and Olympic silver.
This is before we had enough data about Angelique Kerber not being able to perform in uneven years.
Yes. 2019, we were all over Angelique Kerber, sort of knowing what would happen. And Serena was very much, obviously, among the favourites.
Among them, not a heavy favourite. I'm trying to remember how much of a favourite she was.
She'd slightly lost a bit of momentum at the end of the 2016 season when she lost to Pliskova in New York. Then she didn't play at all, and then her first tournament in 2017 was her infamous first trip to Auckland, where she hit 88 unforced errors and lost to Madison Brengel and described the conditions as abhorrent.
It's not a good day, that, is it?
No.
88 unforced errors and a loss to Madison Brengel. Although Madison Brengel had reached, it was the previous year's Australian Open that she had reached the quarterfinals, or at least the fourth round. That was when I cuddled the koala with her. I really associate Madison Brengel with success at the with unexpected Australian success for that for that reason.
And then Venus Williams didn't have a whole lot of form either. She'd also been to Auckland, and she'd beaten the world number 1099 Jade Lewis from New Zealand, a wild card, in the first round, but then pulled out of her second round match against Naomi Osaka.
She thought, that's all I need, all the practice I need. Got my big win. Off I go.
Well, she was right.
Jade Lewis, the ultimate hitting partner, available for hire. I don't know if she is.
But what I would say about Venus at this point in her career, she is showing up at Slams. 2016, round four, Roland Garros, semi-final at Wimbledon, round four, US Open, lost 7-6 in the third to Pliskova, who had reached the final. So I think Venus Williams fans were still in that stage where they're extremely happy and appreciative that she's still playing. But there is also a bit of expectancy that she can have some results, especially if a draw were to open.
Who did we all predict to win? And I would like to include Simon in that to hopefully distract attention away from our predictions.
Do you know, I'm going to have to admit, I didn't make it to the end of that podcast to get your final predictions. But
you know
I
what?
Think
That's
you
fine.
Were mainly talking up Serena.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll take
of course
it.
We
I'll
were,
take
Catherine.
It. I'll take
we
it.
Definitely went for a Serena win. I can feel it.
Can you ever, anyway. Can you ever remember mentioning on air, David, the possibility, not the prediction, the possibility of a Brit double?
Ooh.
Because I remember daring to mention it off air in conversations with producers and so on. Just sort of, you know, it's not for like the first time in anyone's lifetime, it's not ludicrous to say the words. I'm trying to remember if I ever would have said it on air.
I can't remember either.
Think
but
so.
As that tournament was going on, now I think Contra had beaten Radvanska, hadn't she, in the final of that Sydney tournament, and just looked sensational.
Yep.
And looking through Matt's day by day chronicling of this tournament, there are memories that come back to me of when she beat Naomi Osaka and then absolutely thrashed Caroline Wozniacki. Mm. And when she won those, I thought she could win the whole thing. Mm. I really did. I thought, and we'll, you know, we'll get to what happened in the quarterfinals, but that the quarterfinals came as a surprise to me, the way it ended up happening. And Murray coming into this tournament, as you said, he'd played Djokovic in Doha. He was having good early round success. Reading here that he played Andre Rublev, a qualifier, on day three and lost just five games. You know, he's doing what he should be doing at that sort of stage. So I can't remember, Catherine, whether I would have said that. But thinking back, I was very confident in the way Murray and Konta were playing. And like you said at the start, if somebody had said they'd go out in the fourth round for Murray, I would have thought that was absurd. Mm. And for Konta, knowing that Serena was likely to be that opponent in the quarterfinals, I think, you know, you're still the sensible thing to do is to still make Serena Williams the favourite. But I thought Konta was playing well enough to have a real chance, chance. And actually, it's looking at day one, I mean, I really remember the first round and the second round of Federer and how unconvincing he was.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, you've got here, Matt, that he played Jürgen Meltzer, similar sort of age player, another junior Wimbledon champion the following year, I think, from Federer, actually, 99. But that it was a rusty performance. It was four sets. And then he played Noah Rubin in the second round. And I remember those rounds and thinking, Crikey, he looks good considering what he's had to come through, but he looks nowhere near what he will need to be to make serious progress. Is that how it came across to you?
Totally. And I was really, really struck by something Federer said in his press conference after that first round match against Meltzer. He said, I was practicing fine, the warm-up was fine, and then the first game, I was so nervous, and I just hit four frames immediately. He said, "Oh, this is not going to be as easy as I thought."
That's so Federer.
It's a classic Federer line. And you absolutely agree. Watching those two first matches, you never would have thought that Federer would find the form that he did quite quickly, actually. We'll get there, but certainly those first two matches, Federer is looking rusty. That's one of the big stories of those first few days.
I don't want to spoiler things for anyone that's sort of on the edge of their seat and has no memory of what happened in 2017, but with the benefit of hindsight, it now looks like it was the absolutely perfect draw at every round for Roger Federer. And that might be sort of editorialising things after the fact, but it was just the right amount of test at each stage, I think.
Yeah, no, agreed. Just to quickly run through a few other things which happened in the first few days. The very first result on the Rod Laver Arena, talk about setting the tone for the tournament. Shelby Rogers beat number 4 seed Simona Halep 6-3, 6-1. That is not a match I remember, I'll be honest. I didn't remember that happened.
I don't.
I think I remember walking through the gates on the first day and
being out.
And that big screen at those gates you walk to by the nearest entrance to the media centre. I remember seeing on the big screen, oh, goodness, that's a thing that's happening. Must get in earlier. Future.
Note to self.
Yeah.
Serena beat Belinda Bencic in her first match. And I remember that being a statement performance. Bencic, former top 10 player who had some injury troubles, dropped down the rankings a bit, but was dangerous. And Serena was really good in that performance. Ivo Karlovic played the longest match in Australian Open history in terms of games. He came back from two sets down to beat Zabaios 6-7, 3-6, 7-5, 6-2, 22-20, which is just one of those classic early round Grand Slam matches storylines.
Now, I remember that vividly.
If there's anyone out there that saw all of that,
well,
tell us.
Well, it was a tall man, and David was commentating on it.
Well, what happened was that we were doing the other matches on the other courts because, you know, you don't exactly put Ivo Karlovic on your schedule of matches to commentate on as such. And it was on court 68 or whatever against Horacio Zabaios. But when it went into the fifth set and it started to go 16-15 in the fifth, and he's come back and he's, you know, he's nearly 40 years of age and all the rest of it, and then he ends up winning, they decided to get me to watch that the end of that match and to sort of let them know when it looked like the end was coming. And I always remember that he was incredibly animated at the end of it in a way that you just don't associate with Ivo Karlovic whatsoever. And I remember my commentary got clipped up and got stuck out on social media because I said Ivo Karlovic is going to be out tonight. Watch out, nightclubs. He's ready to celebrate because he looked like he was high-fiving members of the crowd and he looked like he was up for a big one after that win.
What a thought.
Yeah, well, he looked ready. He looked ready for fun, and a hell of a win.
One of those moments when you're clipped on social media for a good reason.
Yeah, I've had my share of the other.
I think we all have. And then one of the other stories of this tournament of the first few days is Dan Evans. Again, this is something I'd slightly forgotten about, but on day three, Dan Evans knocked out Marin Cilic in four sets. for what at the time was his first top 10 win at a Grand Slam. It's still his only top 10 win at a Grand Slam. What are your recollections of Dan Evans in that tournament?
I remember we had requested a win-only on-court flash interview with Dan Evans and that Chilich match, and it was played on court number 3, which is my favourite court at the Australian Open. And after he lost the first set to Chilich, I kind of wrote that one off in terms of my mental schedule of where I might have to run to and be based and sort of be on alert for. And then sort of suddenly the tide started to turn and I suddenly realised I needed to be on red alert for what was happening on court number 3. And remember watching the latter stages of it in the tunnel, just at the entrance to the court. But you could only see one of the players at one end. You couldn't see where the ball was coming from or going to. So I was sort of reading the score and how it was unfolding on the basis of the body language of whoever was down that end of the court at the time. I remember it was extraordinarily hot. I remember interviewing Dan Evans after the match, and it was a really good interview, really, really good interview. I remember sort of asking him, I bet you're busting to check your phone and see how many messages you've got. And he said, yeah, one or two, probably.
I remember the next match when he played Bernard Tomic and he beat him and he had a run-in, I think, with Bernard's box, his dad, or certainly people in his box.
There was aggro going in, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah. And then after it, he gave one of the all-time great press conferences. I mean, and I don't feel like I'm exaggerating, because there were journalists there like Mike Dixon, who's been to 25 years worth of press conferences, and he was acclaiming this. And I mean, for a start, Evans was very emotional. He was paying tribute to his former coach who passed away, Julian Hofelein, a year or two earlier. And he was just having us in hysterics as well. First of all, he was just being completely open, you know, about all of his own past failings and wanting to put things right and all this. And then he told everybody this tale about how Kevin Peterson had blanked him in the Crown Casino a couple of nights earlier. And he'd gone up to him and said, can I have a picture? And Kevin Peterson, the cricketer, had just said, just carried on walking. So Evans, having won 3 matches at the Australian Open, just tweets Kevin Peterson, maybe next time you can stop for me when I ask for a picture. And Peterson was having to do some severe damage limitation on Twitter.
Was this the tournament when Dan Evans was Son's shirt sponsor?
Think so, yeah.
And he had to go down the local supermarket and just buy a load of plain white t-shirts.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah,
I remember doing a flash interview with him on I think it was still called High Sense Arena at the time, but now Melbourne Arena, that he played that match against Bernard Tomic, and I mustered up the courage to ask him about the aggro with Tomic, expecting him to sort of play it down because he'd got the win by that stage. And he totally stoked it up. He basically said the verbal equivalent of, yeah, well, that's 2 fingers up to him and his awful team, isn't it? It was brilliant.
And the aggro going in was that Bernard Tomic's team didn't think Dan Evans was good enough to have as a practice partner, is that right?
Which is a mega diss, isn't it?
It really is. Pop quiz question. Ooh. Who was due to be Dan Evans's doubles partner at the 2017
Kyrgios?
Australian Open? Nick Kyrgios, yes.
Because they'd played together at the previous US Open.
Mm.
And that had been a very short-lived treat.
When you say due to be, did it not happen?
No, it didn't. It didn't happen. I think partly because Evans was having a run in the singles, and partly because of what happened to Kyrgios. And the context for Kyrgios is that this was his first tournament back after his suspension at the end of 2016, which he got for tanking that match in Shanghai. He took a 2-set lead on Andreas Seppi in the second round and then lost the last three sets 6-4, 6-2, 10-8 on the Hisense Arena. And it was an exhilarating match, but Kyrgios got booed off because the Australian fans didn't think he was trying by the end. And speaking of interesting press conferences, Kyrgios gave quite an extraordinary press conference where first it was put to him that John McEnroe was on the commentary and McEnroe had said that he didn't think Kyrgios was trying. Kyrgios did not enjoy that line of questioning or those or those comments from McEnroe. He made some very sarcastic comments saying, John McEnroe, good on him, great career. And then someone asked him, are you still consulting a sports psychologist? Is that person here or on the phone? And Kyrgios said, yeah, I am. Ask Johnny Mac. He'll know. Talk to him. He knows everything.
Ooh. As Nick Kyrgios might say, salty.
Yes. But kind of amid those shots that he fired, there was actually some really revealing, interesting stuff in that press conference. He was very open about how he had completely botched his preseason. He said, I didn't have the best preparation. That's on me. Poor management. I did some things in the off season which I won't do again. My body's not in good enough shape. I played basketball and I hurt my knee. And then he was really questioned a lot about the need for a coach. And reading these quotes now, 4 years later, he still hasn't ever really properly had a coach. He says, the coach is always a question mark for me. I think that's one area where I obviously need to start taking it more seriously. There's not anyone in the top 100 without a coach except for me. That needs to change. Preseason's important part of the year. You build your foundations for the rest of the year. I didn't do that, and it's on me. So kind of a classic Nick Kyrgios press conference. You've got these moments, these lines where he's being really sarcastic, but actually he's also giving you a real insight there into who he is and how he feels. It's very interesting, I thought.
I remember seeing the papers the next day after that performance against Seppi. And let's just say they didn't focus on those more sort of reflective and introspective comments. It was pretty savage from the Australian press. And look, there was reason to criticise that performance, absolutely.
I seem to remember you and I had a bit of an argument about him after that match. I think you were just done with him for his behaviour as he walked off that court. I mean, he obviously reeled you back in within about 3 months because, you know, he went on that amazing run with Miami, didn't he?
Yeah. Shame, the cycle of self-flagellation.
I've done my circuits with him as well.
but you were still, were you big picture more optimistic about him?
I just remember having
a row with me.
I just remember having a row with you.
Right, that's okay. You were being an early days Kyrie optimist.
Yeah. What else was happening, Matt?
So we've arrived at day four. Day four is the first real day of shocks. You know, we've had some interesting storylines, some excellent matches, but day four is where it really takes off, I think. First match of the day, as we've already mentioned, is Joe Konta beating Osaka 6-4, 6-2. And I remember feeling the same as you. I think there's probably been three times where I've thought Joe Konta had a chance of winning a slam. And the 2017 Australian Open was the first of those. She was just in the most incredible form and had completely developed a winning formula that worked for her. And I remember Osaka really praising Konta after the match and really talking her up. And then later in the day on the Rod Laver Arena is a huge result, a seismic shock, and it's world number 117, Denis Istomin, beating six-time champion Novak Djokovic in five sets. Djokovic's earliest loss at a Grand Slam since Wimbledon in 2008, and the first time he'd ever lost to a player ranked outside of the top 100. Istomin gave one of the great lines of the tournament afterwards, where he said, I just feel sorry for Novak. I was playing so good today.
They loved that line. Djokovic loved that line.
As I said at the start of this podcast, it's an interesting time for Djokovic. We don't really know where he's at in his career. And I found a clip from the podcast where you two are reacting to that match, trying to diagnose what is wrong with Djokovic, and talking about your experience of watching this match. Just a word of warning on behalf of you two in terms of these clips generally, a lot of name dropping going on during the 2017 Australian Open. Quite a lot of name dropping in these clips to come, but really interesting.
Absolute stitch up.
So here we go. This is your assessment of that match immediately afterwards.
It was hard to fathom from Novak Djokovic. Look, Dennis Istomin played really, really well, but there is no way he should have been challenging Novak Djokovic. I mean, even on his best day, he doesn't really have the game to challenge Novak Djokovic. It's just not a good matchup. The seismic ripples are still reverberating, aren't they, around here? It's difficult to sum up just how big a shock this is. And had it not been for what happened in Doha, I would have found today more easier to understand. Had it been sort of a continuation of what we saw from the end of last season, from what we saw in the World Tour Finals final against Andy Murray, it would have made more sense to me. What doesn't make sense to me is that we saw certainly the old Novak Djokovic in terms of spirit in Doha. And why couldn't we see that today? Because we didn't really see that today. How he lost, you know, it's a familiar story, isn't it? The plucky underdog challenges the top seed, one of the top seeds. But then as soon as the top seed gets a bit between his teeth and gets some momentum in his direction, as Djokovic did, winning the second and third sets, you think, oh, OK, no, this has been an exciting match. We're all very grateful for that. But normal service is resumed now. How he went on to lose the fourth and fifth sets is very bizarre to me. I watched prepare yourself for some name dropping, but I did actually watch portions of the match, sat in between Boris Becker and Mats Wilander. And Boris wasn't giving too much away. He wasn't, you know, letting it all go. He obviously still has a whole load of fondness for Novak Djokovic, wishes him well. But I mean, his basic assessment was he's just flat today. And both of them, these two greats of the game, didn't really have any more of a scientific explanation than that. It's weird, isn't it? Flat. That was sort of it, you know, and they were talking amongst themselves about, it's just awful when you come out and you're flat, isn't it? What are you supposed to do about it? And I'm thinking, surely you find a way to get yourself pumped up. But no, they were saying it's just one of those things that you just hope it doesn't happen on a day that's really, really important. Now, I do believe that had Djokovic of a year ago come out flat, he would have found a way to not be flat by the final point. That's the issue here. But yeah, it was. I can't believe it actually happened. Really, not that I thought that Novak Djokovic was nailed on to win this title, but of all the, you know, looking at his potential route through to the latter stages, of all the people you thought could possibly challenge him, nobody was looking at Dennis Istomin, were they?
No, I remember seeing Dennis Istomin walk out onto the court, and I remember thinking, oh, I hadn't even realised Djokovic was playing him. That's how little it had registered on my radar that this was a match coming up and that this was a threat. It wasn't a threat. There was no threat there as far as I was concerned for Novak Djokovic today. Well, I was absolutely wrong. First of all, have to pay enormous credit, I think, to Istomin, who played the match of his life, and he just didn't dip, he didn't blink. I think it's very easy to only analyse why wasn't Djokovic like Djokovic normally is, and that's obviously the biggest storyline here, and it's my first instinct is Djokovic of a year ago doesn't lose that match, no matter what Istomin does, and I still believe that. However, you know, the guy played fabulously well. But trying to get to the bottom of what is wrong with Novak Djokovic is, we will never do it, and he's not telling us, and maybe he doesn't even know, but there's something wrong with him. I mean, he's not, this guy is not right at the moment. I mean, this, why isn't he at the level he was a year ago? It happens. Bjorn Borg walked out of the 1981 US Open final, never won another Grand Slam tournament, basically retired. You know, Roger Federer has gone through that awful spell around 2013, 2014, when he was losing to all sorts of people. Nadal, over the last 2 years, has lost the confidence with the forehand. I think it's so stark to see a guy win four Grand Slam titles in a row and look a year ago like he just couldn't be beaten. I'm pretty bereft, really. I mean, other than to say, I just think he's lost the edge, because how many times can you go into the reserves and when you've dug deep all these times and there isn't the same cause for him? He's reached all the peaks. Good analysis, that, wasn't it?
Aged very well.
I do think. I can't exactly remember at what point the elbow became really apparent as an issue. But I mean, he admitted later, didn't he? He did that interview with Simon Briggs about burnout, just being, he just lost. He'd lost his edge. But it was a massive shock. It's quite good to have listened to that rather than try to remember now, because at that point he was such a big deal in terms of dominating the sport. Okay, Murray had reeled him in at the end of the previous year, but four slams in a row, I mean, says everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he'd beaten the world number one in his warm-up tournament.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, in the Doha final. Yeah, that was the first of my Garden Square reaction videos. The Djokovic loss.
That's never been seen by us since until today. 4 years in the phone. What happened next, Matt?
Well, the other big thing that happened on that day was that Lucic Baroni came to people's attention for the first time in this tournament as she beat Radvanska 6-3, 6-2. Radvanska was the number three seed. It kind of feels like ages ago that she retired.
God.
But she was still a real force 2017. And this was the first time Lucic Baroni had reached the third round of the Australian Open since 1998. This was one of the most incredible stories, really, of these 2 weeks. The reemergence of Lucic Baroni, someone who had had this meteoric rise, really, as a teenager in the late 90s. I think she won Australian Open doubles with Hingis, and she became the youngest player ever to defend a title. She was 16 years old when she defended her first title. And then in 1999, she reached the semifinals of Wimbledon and then disappeared, really. She had lots of personal problems, an abusive father, and she just wasn't around for many years and threatened a few comebacks. But this tournament was the first time where she properly made a name for herself again.
Mm. Mm. I remember you feeling, I knew embarrassingly little about the Mariana Lucic Baroni story. And I remember you filling me in on it. And I remember thinking, how did I not know about all of that? It's even in the genre of, you know, really desperately sad and tragic tennis parent stories, it's one of the worst of those. It's really horrifying. And I remember being very taken aback at hearing the story and immediately becoming really invested in the Mariana Lucic Baroni storyline at that tournament, which panned out well for me and for her.
So I think the shockwaves from that day were felt, particularly the next day. And this is kind of the next point I have. Federer plays his third round match the day after Djokovic loses. And I remember feeling this at the time, that the whole dynamic of the tournament shifted for Federer when Djokovic goes out. Because Djokovic has been Federer's obstacle for the last few years. He's beaten him in Wimbledon finals, a US Open final, a Australian Open semi-final. He cannot get past Djokovic. And I don't know whether it was as perfect as this, but it seemed like as soon as Djokovic went out of the tournament, a weight lifted from Federer's shoulders. He felt liberated and he played an astonishingly good match. After a couple of rusty matches, he destroyed Thomas Burdick, who was a top 10 player. That match was being really hyped, you know, a potential threat for Federer here. And Federer just made him look silly, really. I remember the amount of drop shots he was hitting and the way he was getting Burdick off balance. It was suddenly, for the first time, I think people thought, okay, Federer is a real threat in this tournament.
Yeah, I think it was at best 50-50 in terms of people saying that Federer would win this match. Mm. I think Burdick, in the eyes of many, was the favourite. I mean, the guy has not played for 6 months, and he's not fit, and he's not looked very good for the first two rounds. I must admit, coming into the match, I don't recall thinking Djokovic's defeat makes any difference to Federer, personally. I don't recall feeling that. Now you've said it, it makes sense. And I just focused, I suppose, on the performance of Federer in isolation. Mm. It felt to me, suddenly it clicked, and I didn't know why. Now, maybe the Djokovic thing happened, but you saying that he made him look silly is right. Because it was, I remember laughing a lot during that match, because and Burdick was laughing. Burdick was like, well, what is this? I mean, you know, I've played this guy a lot of times. He's got a lot of wins against Federer. He had a period when he was beating him more often than not, around 2010, something like that. But he was made to look cumbersome, like an articulated lorry up against a Lamborghini. It was incredible what Federer did to him.
I think it was the first sight of Federer's improved backhand, I think, as well in that match, which would go on to become a feature.
I did think after that match, as early as it was, I thought he could win this. If he plays like that, who's going to stop him? You know, he's playing. That's the best performance that we will see all fortnight, is what I thought.
Mm. The next day is the day that Joe Konta thrashes Caroline Wozniacki, which we've made reference to already. Wozniacki said afterwards that she thinks Konta has a real chance of beating Serena if they meet in the quarterfinals, kind of backing up everything that we've just said. That was also the day Nadal beat Alexander Zverev in a highly anticipated third round match. Lasted over 4 hours. I think that was probably the first time I'd ever really, truly realized the potential of Zverev. I mean, he'd been talked about for a long time, but I don't think I'd ever seen him play so well against a top player, and he really did play well. I remember thinking that the reason Nadal won that was the five sets. He was able to outlast him. I think Zverev had some physical problems towards the end of that match, but tennis wise, Zverev really, really impressed in that match against Nadal.
Mm. Yeah. I thought Zverev might have him, actually, at 2-1. I was commentating, and I remember being courtside low down, and, you know, Nadal wasn't quite right yet. You know, he was lacking confidence. Zverev looked bang up for it. And actually, those latter two sets were quite important, I think, for Nadal. I think they probably gave him a lot of confidence.
We know how, I mean, confidence is more important for Nadal than any other top player, I think. I completely agree with you. I think actually the fact that he was tested there and came through it, again I can't claim to have been saying or thinking this at the time. It's very much to the benefit of hindsight. But I think those third round matches for both Federer and Nadal were big, big turning points in their tournaments.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So after Nadal and Zverev and their five-set epic, I thought, you know, that's a fair bit of drama, Matt. But day seven, would make that all look a bit tame, as I recall.
Yes, this is where things get really wild. Just just an extraordinary day. One match after the other on the Rod Laver Arena, full of incident, full of drama, full of big implications for the tournament. And the first of those was the biggest of all, really. Misha Zverev beating Andy Murray. 7-5, 5-7, 6-2, 6-4. When I think of this match, I think of a sort of ambush of just sort of coming to the net time after time with 100% commitment to that tactic and executing it, because I would back Murray against that style of play. Murray's traditionally very good against left-handers. He likes a target. And yet, Zverev pulled that off so perfectly that Murray couldn't find the answers on that day. And Zverev served and volleyed 119 times in the match, which just is totally, totally different to any tennis that we see today, really. Taylor Townsend-esque, exactly. Taylor Townsend against Halep at the US Open a year later was another example of it.
I cannot remember what we said about this match and result, David, on the podcast at the time. Matt can probably tell us, but I suspect it's a result that we would view very differently with the benefit of Andy Murray hindsight, don't you think?
Yeah, probably. Actually, just by the way, stylistically, I think I agree with Matt. I mean, I'm fairly sure I was on Five Live because it was middle weekend. I remember doing updates into the football at the weekend and telling everybody how Murray handles this sort of game comfortably, you know. Yeah, that he loves playing serve and volleys and lobbing them to death, you know. Yeah, that made me look a bit stupid.
Well, yeah, I mean, in hindsight, Andy Murray's last chance to win a slam. I mean, I know he had that French Open, but it was always a tough ask for Murray to win the French Open, especially if Nadal was there. And that was the French Open 2017 where his hip was finished.
But, okay, his hip was finished then, but it was, you know, it was a degenerative, cumulative injury.
It was affecting him in this tournament.
I don't want to rewrite history and take too much away from Misha Zverev, but it absolutely has to have been a factor in that match. He was world number one. He was... You know, we were going on what we'd seen at the end of the previous year, that Andy Murray. But realistically, actually, take 2016 out of it. 2017, Andy Murray, even before the French Open, it wasn't quite
well,
right.
He had shingles, didn't he? In the spring, he got unwell a couple of times. And in hindsight, years later, I think he puts his off-season as having overtrained. In that off season between being world number one and playing that event. I mean, he'd had all that run of matches in order to get to world number one as well, hadn't he? All those wins. And I just remember seeing him against Zverev, how angry he was on the court that day. He was so frustrated. He couldn't understand, I think. He couldn't handle playing like that, you know, hot, humid, sort of sweaty day. And Zverev was brilliant. I mean, Misha Zverev was fantastic, exciting. It was real. I remember how excited Pat Cash was alongside me in commentary about the style of play of Zverev that day, because it was just total throwback.
That is exactly what I found when I went back to listen to you two talking about this match. I was expecting you to be quite down about it, but the opposite was true. I think you were both really swept up with the performance of Zverev. And yeah, this is what you said at the time.
Oh, no.
It was swashbuckling serve and volley tennis, the likes of which we haven't seen at an important stage of a Grand Slam tournament. I don't think, maybe the only similar performances that I've seen like that would have been Sergei Stakhovsky serving and volleying Roger Federer off the centre court at Wimbledon in 2013. That's the sort of performance that he produced that day. this was Edberg-like, this was Rafter-like, this was... Pat Cash came in our studio afterwards, and he said, okay, you know, he likes Andy Murray, but he was glowing because he'd seen somebody play the sport like that.
Well, so was Greg Rozeski in the Eurosport studio. You know, the reaction was supposed to be, oh, goodness me, DEFCON 1, Andy Murray's out. And Greg just said, it's just so wonderful to see someone play tennis like that. And he is right, you know, Pat Cash is right. It is... Misha Zverev has won a whole load of new fans today. It was, you know, I think it was yesterday I talked about you know, how these sorts of conditions, the new balls perhaps favour the more compact player. How compact is his forehand? There's no take back at all.
Although it's weird.
It's weird. You wouldn't coach it, but it is compact.
I was giving him a really hard time in the first few games because I don't think I've seen a full match of Misha Zverev before. And he was 3-1 down. A point for 4-1 for a double break for Murray, and he didn't take that opportunity. And you're looking at that forehand, you're thinking, that forehand cannot stand up over the course of a match. The idea that he would beat Andy Murray over five sets, right, it was four in the end, wasn't it, would have seemed ridiculous at that time. From a British perspective, a disappointment not to have Andy Murray still in the tournament. But I don't care. I mean, I sort of feel sorry for Andy. I know there's many people listening to this will be saying, oh, you know, we've gutted about Andy, but... It was a joy to watch somebody play tennis like that.
Absolutely. I feel the same. I mean, obviously, I'm here working for British Eurosport. You're here working for BBC Radio. You know, from a British perspective, it is a shame. But from a neutral's perspective, from a tennis fan's perspective, there is something joyful about such an open draw. I can't remember the last time that really genuinely happened. I mean, yes, okay, at Wimbledon we saw Djokovic tumble out, but we haven't seen the top two men's seeds in a Grand Slam fall out before the quarterfinal stage since the French Open 2004, when Roger Federer and Andy Roddick both lost early. So this is sort of uncharted territory for recent tennis, and I'm looking at this big screen now, and I'm wondering if the Federer Nadal final might not be such a pipe dream. Ooh. Oh, yes, please.
Good one, Catherine.
That was Matt Roberts-esque with that stat there, wasn't it? I definitely got that from some kind of producer or something. So thank you, whoever that might have been.
By the way, that was
so... Can we end the pod there?
That was victim of the moment stuff, talking about how Misha Zverev's win is good for the tournament and all that. I mean, much as I like the guy.
Total bummer.
And much as he's a wonderful player to watch on that day, and his serve and volleying was great. I mean, it's one of those that, yes, it was great to watch at the time, but it just duffed up the whole draw in other ways.
And he's not going to do anything. The thing about it was, that wasn't a tactic that he specifically deployed that day for Andy Murray and executed to perfection. That is how he plays every tennis match.
That's his only option.
That's his only option. And with all due respect, there's a reason why his ranking was where it was and is where it is and has been where it has been for his whole career, during which he's been playing that style of tennis. By and large, these days, that game and the way he executes it isn't good enough to beat top-level players.
There was a helping factor that tournament, which was that they had sped up the courts. It was a really big talking point throughout this tournament that the courts were quicker, the conditions were faster, and it did favour the more attacking players. And Zverev really was rewarded for his game style, I think, by the conditions, by the courts.
I think that line from me on the pod stemmed from the fact that I was asked to do a live piece for Eurosport. So they had the studio back in London, Feltham, to be precise, a glamorous hotspot, very near to Heathrow. That's that's where the Eurosport studios used to be. So they had Rob Curling presenting in the studio there, and I was kind of their on-site presence feeding into the studio. And they sort of, in the shock aftermath of Andy Murray's, right just in the moment of defeat, I think it was, I think he came to press straight away, and it was immediately after that I had to set up for a live hit. And I remember it being a total scramble, didn't have a chance to set up the lighting properly. You're quite limited with where you can do those pieces in Australia, more so than at other slams, the sort of designated spots. And it's always a tough balance because, you know, you're aware of the need to engage the viewer and the desire to make them care still about the tournament. That is your job, to make them care about what you're reporting on, but equally not trying to convince them that it's not an absolute bummer for a British audience to see the world number one, who happens to be a Brit, lose in the fourth round to a bloke that probably most people watching have never heard of. And I remember just sort of throwing it in there at the end of the report. Hey, look at the draw. A Federer-Nadal final, in theory, is still on. And I think I remember the producer sort of saying, oh, good one, as I came off air. So I thought, oh, well, that went down well. I'll rehash that for the pod. Great.
And nail it.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought you'd like that clip.
Thanks, Matt.
That was the day that Federer beat Kei Nishikori in that five-setter, which... Now, Federer won that match against Nishikori in five, but that was a very different feel of match, to me at least, to the one he'd had against Burdick. And I thought, oh, good win, but I think I was swept along by the Burdick win, and I was expecting him to do the same to Nishikori. And go in five, I actually thought, that's probably him done. I don't know about you, but...
I think I had a slightly different feel because Federer was still playing really well against Nishikori. He just had a couple of bad lapses of concentration. He started the match badly, if I remember. I think he might have been 4-love down, 5-1 down. Managed to get that first set back to a tie break, but then really did play well and just had a couple of moments where he went off and Nishikori took advantage. But I agree that I was certainly concerned from a physical perspective. I think there were some rumours at this point that Federer had maybe slightly felt something in his first two rounds, and now he's going five sets against Nishikori. You're looking at the rest of the draw, and Stan Wawrinka's still in it, Rafa Nadal's still in it. You know there are physical tests ahead, likely, if Federer's going to win this tournament. So I guess I was encouraged by the actual tennis he was still playing, but the physical element was certainly becoming a factor. But I think you were watching that match on the big screen while you were recording the pod, and that was kind of the atmosphere you could hear in the background on that clip.
I've just remembered something we haven't relived about that tournament. We haven't relived David casually chatting to Federer backstage moments before and whilst his first match is called.
Yes. David?
That was a thing that happened.
Yeah.
Actually happened.
Well,
don't get all coy now, David. This pod is name drop central.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that as well, to be honest.
I was just stood awkwardly on the sidelines eavesdropping. And he literally looked over at the... I know we've told this story in the pod, but it bears repeating. Looks over at the scoreboard in the little media area, sees that Angelique Kerber, who was the match preceding him, I'm sure it was Kerber.
Yeah, was it?
Was a game away, and went, oh, David, I'm so sorry, I've got to go.
That's all right, fine.
And off he goes to begin his journey. And David said, oh, forget it.
Well, no, I'd just been talking to Ivan Lupicic. I think I was waiting to interview somebody else that day in the area, because the TV interview area was near the player gym, wasn't it? I think. And I remember I'd seen Lupicic, who was just waiting for this match to end, and he came over and I knew him from years back, and we had a little chat. And next thing I know, Federer walks up and he starts having a little chat. And then Catherine walks in and the look on her face was just the best.
Yeah, it was quite something. Anyway, let's whiz back forward in time. But
yeah.
I remember that night. Do you remember the order of matches that night? Was the Van der Weij-Kerber match... The final
after
match.
Federer.
It was after, because we watched David Federer and Nishikori together on that hill, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah, the closing stage. We were waiting for that match to end so that we could record the podcast.
We waited for that match to end, recorded the podcast. I remember Lucy, the producer I worked with at Eurosport and a good friend, she had waited around for me. She'd watched the Nishikori match with us and then waited around for me while we recorded the pod. And then as I think you had headed off and then presumably to edit and upload and stay up for the next 6 hours... And we were loitering there, deciding what to do. And a couple of fans were leaving. And they came over and said, hey, we've got to head off. Do you want our tickets on the Rod Laver Arena? And as broadcasters, we don't really get access to press seats on court at the Australian Open. I love that tournament. But until last year when I was there for the podcast with Matt, I barely saw any live tennis. I saw some on the outside courts where it was more of a free-for-all, but on the show courts, I barely saw a ball struck on the show courts. So this was quite a big deal, and we thought, can we do this? And we thought, yeah, we can just take our accreditations off and be fans for the evening. We've both finished work. So I went in and watched. David thinking, well, you know, watching live, that's no big deal, is it? You were probably commentating on it or something. But for me, that was quite a big deal. Watching that match, cool. Seeing it live,
I didn't
and
know
seeing
that.
Seeing the defending champion go out. And it's funny, when we were preparing for this pod and going through that tournament and matches we wanted to relive and moments we wanted to relive, none of the three of us could remember who the fourth semi-finalist was on the women's side. We remembered Venus and Serena, obviously. We all remembered the Mariana Lucic-Baroni story. And none of us could get Coco Vandeweghe.
Yeah, who was awesome, wasn't she, in that tournament? She did play amazing tennis, actually, and full of attitude as well, and right in everybody's face. Smashed Kerber off the court, smashed Muguruza off the court later on, you know. And it was quite something that she... I thought she was going to go all the way, I must say, the way she was playing.
Crikey. That's a big call.
I did, yeah. The way she—I mean, I can't remember what I said on the podcast. Probably completely the opposite.
you were probably hedging.
Probably.
She was so unapologetically confident, in her own abilities. I mean, now I just hear the name Coco, and I just don't expect Vandeweghe to follow it.
Oh God, that's so damning.
Had we ever heard of Coco Gauff at that point? I wonder if she had become somebody we were aware of on the junior scene at that point or not. I'm not sure. Might be too early.
Possibly. I think 2018.
I think 2018.
Was when, she would have been 13, I think, in 2017. Even for her, that would have been a bit... I mean, I'm sure some people were aware of her, but I doubt I was.
Mm. But so Murray losing and Kerber losing on the same day meant that it was the first time since the 2004 French Open that both number one seeds had lost before the quarterfinals. And the fact that it happened on the same day, on the same court, just hours after each other, is just yet another indication of what a sort of outlier this 2017 Australian Open was. And I think this was the time, you know, we heard Catherine there on the podcast mention Federer and Nadal, the possibility of it for the first time. It was around this point in the tournament, day 7, day 8, where the possibility is becoming real. I spoke to our friend and colleague Andrew, who is a massive Venus Williams fan. They share a birthday, and he's a massive Venus fan.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he said that this was the time where he allowed his mind to wander and the possibility of Venus being able to have a really strong tournament was suddenly becoming more possible. He was sort of daring to dream about that happening. And the next clip we've got, I think, reflects that mood, that feeling. And this is a chat that Catherine had with Andy Roddick. By this point, you'll hear the questions you're putting to Roddick are about this gathering story of, is this a throwback slam? Are we going to get Federer Nadal? Are we going to get Venus Serena? And I just think it sort of captures the mood quite well of this middle portion of the tournament where all these storylines were converging and becoming quite real before us.
I learned a long time ago not to be surprised by Roger Federer or anything he's capable of. It's amazing, and you know the joy he still gets from it is insane. You know, he talked about, I was reading his first match in Perth. He was talking about jittery going down there and like the bell. I mean, it's just great to see. You know, time is undefeated, but he's putting up a pretty good fight against it.
Does this kind of feel like a bit of a throwback tournament? A lot of people talking about the different conditions this year, the different balls. Do you think, you know, almost the fates are conspiring to create this throwback Australian Open? We've got Serena and Venus and Roger and Rafa. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been a huge fan of different conditions. I don't know that we should play similar conditions, similar ball speed, similar across 12 months. I like the variation. It allows for a roll of the dice sometimes, as you saw Zverev and Murray or Istomin and Djokovic, where someone can really be aggressive, kind of flatline and just play insane risk tennis and have it come up good. You know, I'm sure Roger wasn't too disappointed when he got here and hit for the first time, though.
Roger and Rafa is still in the draw. Everyone is already thinking about the mere prospect of a Roger Rafa final. What would that be for tennis?
Well, I think it could be the most historically significant match ever. If you think about where they're at as far as 17 and 14, let's say Rafa walks off a winner in that matchup. 17-15 with the French Open around the corner, he's back in the game. He's back in the conversation. You know, Roger wins, it's 18-14. I don't know that there's enough time to make up that difference, and he's probably going to, you know, sit on that that record for a long time. So it's fascinating. I know the tennis world would want to just reach out and give that matchup a big hug. and also when they're playing their best. Finals of a Grand Slam, you know, they might end up playing in round of 16s when, you know, they're at the tail end of their careers, and that'll be great too. But in form, playing well, a bit of a throwback, it'd be amazing, especially when, and I was certainly part of the conversation, when there were questions on if we'd ever see them in prime form again against each other.
Just finally, before I push you for a prediction on the men's side, I have to ask you about Serena, Venus, and Coco Vandeweghe holding things up for the American women. How about them?
It's nuts to say. I think Coco's played the best of anyone this far in the tournament. You know, and with Venus, I mean, getting to the semis after 14 years, I mean, just the persistence and... When she was 70 in the world and having you know, autoimmune problems and everything, I didn't think she would ever be at the business end of a slam again. And you know, she loves it, and she's out there doing it. And it's amazing to me. You know, this tournament's proof of why these people are icons and legends of the sport. Whether it's Roger and Rafa or Venus and Serena, we expect it from Serena still. But you know, there's a reason they have certain definitions next to their names, and it's coming up this event.
Finally then, I'm going to push you. You're a punchy guy. I'm going to get a punchy answer from you, I hope. Who's winning the two titles here?
Gosh, it's so tough. I mean, I think any tournament Serena goes into, I'm happy choosing her. I'd be lying if I said I could say anyone on the men's side with confidence. I think it all depends on matchups. You know, if Roger gets Raonic in the final, I actually like him because I think that's a good matchup for him. And I've seen that matchup a lot of, or a very similar matchup a lot of times. You know, Roger can be playing great. We've seen it before. But the matchup with Rafa, what Rafa does well bothers Roger more than what anyone else does well against him. So Roger can be playing great, but it doesn't change the matchup, especially if Rafa's in prime form. I haven't seen Rafa this good in 3 years. You know, even maybe 2 years when he won the French Open last, but I mean, he's playing with a belief system right now that hasn't been in the last year and a half. He looks like vintage Nadal. So that matchup hasn't changed. If Rafa gets through Milos, which I think is a tall ask, it's all based on matchups, and you're asking me to predict a matchup. But I like Roger if he doesn't have to play Rafa. I like Rafa if he doesn't lose to Milos.
Well, that all aged well.
Yeah, relatively nearly, Andy, nearly. But I enjoyed the grilling. Catherine
was quite grilling, wasn't it?
Refusing to let him go without saying exactly what's going to happen.
Oh, it came over me.
Very funny.
I was swept up in it all.
It's great.
He went big on Vandeweghe too, David.
Yeah. Well,
he did.
I just remember how her tennis was brash. In your face, and she was just going to rip it from you. And I was surprised she lost to Venus Williams in the semifinals.
And of course, she reached the US Open semifinals that year as well, the year that Sloane Stephens won. And then I know she's had bad injuries, but she has completely disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, they were really bad injuries as well. I mean, and I think she's somebody who needs to be able to keep playing. And the moment that her legs were taken from under her because of those injuries, you know, she wasn't stable on the court. If you look at the way she plays, it's a very expressive game, very ambitious game. She needs balance. She needs that foundation. And I just don't think it's been there ever since, really.
So that was day nine, that interview with Andy Roddick, who was there for, I think he was there for the Hall of Fame announcement.
Yeah,
he was getting inducted. Yeah. And that was a day, as you said, David, Vandeweghe thrashed Muguruza 6-4, 6-love. And that set up this semifinal with Venus Williams, who'd beaten Pavlyuchenkova to become the oldest woman to make a Grand Slam semi-final since Martina Navratilova in 1994 at Wimbledon. And on that same day, Wawrinka and Federer had set up their semi-final clash with a couple of straightforward wins over Tsonga and Misha Zverev. Day 10, if there was a slightly disappointing day or a slightly quiet day, this might be the one. The men's matches were straight sets. Dimitrov beating Goffin, Nadal beating Raonic. That was big for Nadal, I think, turning the tables on Raonic after he'd lost to him in Brisbane. The Lucic-Baroni story just kept going as she beat Pliskova in three sets. And then from a British perspective, I guess the headline match of the day was Serena Williams against Jo Konta in the quarterfinals. And David, you said earlier you were surprised in the end by how sort of one-sided that match was. Serena won it 6-2, 6-3.
I felt Serena came out and decided she was going to show Johanna Konta what it's all about that day. Mm. I think she'd heard enough of the hype. She'd heard enough of us lot and all the British media saying how well Konta's playing and giving her a chance to win. And I think Konta was shocked that day. I think she went out there really thinking she got a good chance. I think it's like a boxer who's a contender going up against a champion and thinking, I'm ready for this. And then just getting chinned in the first round and realizing what they're up against. And Serena was unstoppable that day.
But I also think that performance and what you described there was a mark of respect for Jo Konta and how well she was playing. You know, think about what I said about Patrick Mouratoglou. You know, that was on the eve of the tournament that he said that Serena's card was marked about Jo Konta's form. Serena Williams knew that she needed to play her best tennis, knew that she had to be on it for that one. She'd been eyeing that match up from the start. And that's why she came out so hot.
These greats, I think they occasionally just hear or read these murmurings about how well somebody's playing and what that might mean when they play them. And they steel themselves and the greats will want to send a message out to show everybody who's boss. Mm.
Mm. So that takes us to women's semi-final day. And this is the day I think of as Venus Williams' day. I'm actually surprised I couldn't remember Coco Vandeweghe reaching the semis because I remember this moment so vividly of Venus reaching the final. I've just sort of forgotten who her opponent was. This is one of the lasting images of this tournament for me in my mind. Venus's celebration when she beats Coco Vandeweghe. First of all, again, I'll quote Andrew here because he can say it better than me. He said, Venus's final was the match against Vandeweghe in so many ways. And it's hard to admit that, but even at the time it felt like that because Serena was almost certainly waiting in the final. But this was Venus's moment and she lost the first set to Vandeweghe on a tie break. And then for someone who's so stoic usually, she came out in that second set, gritted her teeth, and fought. And I think she fended off double-digit break points in those second and third sets, kept Vandeweghe at bay. She was going for huge second serves. Her serve was working better in that tournament than it had been for years. And then when she finally won it, as I said, this reaction, this celebration, just this outpouring of joy, of ecstasy. This, you know, she'd waited 10 years almost for this, to be back in a Grand Slam final. It was her first one since 2009 at Wimbledon. She was 36 years old, the oldest Australian Open singles finalist in the Open era. And yeah, it's one of the defining images of the tournament for me. I hadn't seen Venus Williams do that for years, probably since she beat Davenport in that Wimbledon final that we relived last summer, where she sort of bounced up and down sort of with joy. It was a very similar thing. She was twirling, she was glowing, and that moment is Venus Williams's moment.
Foreshadowing alert here, but seeing elder great champions be childlike and have a sense of wonder, wide-eyed wonder about winning, is a glorious and infectious sight. And that was one moment of that, and there was another of those which spoiler alert is to come.
And as it turned out, Serena would be waiting in the final, because Serena beat Lucic Baroni 6-2, 6-1, made it to the final without dropping a set. Serena looking absolutely incredible. One of my least favourite things about the Australian Open is probably the way they schedule those two women's semi-finals during the day on the Thursday, and then the men get the night session slots on the Thursday and Friday for their semi-finals. And the men's semi-final that night was Federer-Wawrinka, and that was another five-set match for Federer after his five-setter against Nishikori in round four. I don't actually remember a huge amount about this match. It was a slightly strange scoreline. Federer took the first two sets. Then, you know, those physical worries that we perhaps mentioned early on in the tournament seemed to be coming to bear. He lost the third set 6-1. He lost the fourth set 6-4. But then somehow dug in and managed to win the fifth set and make it through to the final.
I remember vividly him taking an extended off-court injury timeout between the fourth and fifth sets. David, would you have been in the commentary booth for that?
Yeah, I remember Pat Cash calling it something like legal cheating. And that being put to Federer in his press conference afterwards, which is always, I always feels a bit sly, you know, taking a pundit's line like that and putting it to the player, you know. But it's what a lot of us do. I'm sure I've done it before. And Federer was very much defending himself and saying, look, I'm the last person who goes for the trainer and all this sort of stuff, and I've never retired from a match. And he's quite right in many ways. But it was very clear that he was just making sure that he could just have a bit of a break and maybe disrupt the other guy a bit. I'm sure there was a bit of that in that decision, because he'd won the first two sets. He lost the next two. He looked uncomfortable. He didn't look fully fit, to be quite honest, at the end of that semi-final, but he still had enough to beat Stan. Wasn't a classic though, that match. I don't recall that being a classic.
No, I mean, the fact that I remember it most for that injury timeout, not a ringing endorsement, but I mean, obviously it was a, you know, an enjoyable watch. The bar was high that fortnight, wasn't it?
And the classic was the next day.
Yeah.
The classic was the second men's semi-final, Dimitrov against Nadal.
That was the match of the tournament.
I agree. I think this is the highest quality match of the tournament, the one with the sort of sustained drama all the way through, both players playing brilliantly at the same time. How do you remember that match, Catherine?
You inviting me to name drop?
Oh, yeah.
If you like.
I remember watching a lot of it with Mats Wilander, who was just fanboying about the level of tennis. Not on air, obviously, in the Eurosport green room. And he was just, you know, I've said on the pod before, watching Mats Wilander watch tennis is such an uplifting thing, because he's just like a little kid. He loves watching good quality tennis so much. And I just remember his eyes being wide with
sort of ecstasy watching. I mean, he was quite literally on the edge of his seat. He was on the edge of his sort of bonquette for that match. And it's funny, I went for a walk on Monday. That's what counts as a really big time social engagement these days. I went for a socially distant walk on Wimbledon Common with Lucy, the producer I was working with at that Australian Open. And I said, we're reliving that Australian Open on the pod this Friday. And she, you know, she, this wistful look came about and she said, oh, those were good times, weren't they? And I said, yeah. And I said, you know, what jumps out at you? And she, that is the match that she most remembers. That's the match and the moment and the watching experience that immediately jumped out for her. And I can understand why, quality wise, for two players sustaining their best level simultaneously over five sets, that was the one.
Yeah, I didn't commentate on that match. I remember I was doing updates into the sports desk. I just didn't happen to be on the commentary for it. But I remember watching every single ball on the TV, mouth wide open, and loving it. I was loving every ball of it. I think partly because it was just a great tennis match, but also it was the moment that Grigor Dimitrov was showing what he was made of. And that, because we'd been running the podcast for 5 years by that point and hyping this guy to the heavens because we loved the way he played, and yet so often he didn't really deliver. And on that night, he delivered. He showed so much heart to go with ability and the physicality and the ability to run with Nadal side to side for hours on end. And I also thought, that was one of the matches I did actually kind of get a prediction right. I said it'll be a classic, and yet, but Nadal will win in the end. And I don't think it was possible for Dimitrov to win it in the end, because he did everything he could. He played incredible tennis, and that shows what Nadal is like when he's, as Andy Roddick was saying earlier, when he's in form like that. How do you stop him? Well, obviously, we'll find out how somebody would stop him. But the thing is, in that match, it's like, how do you rip the bone out of his jaws? How do you do it? Because he's not going to let go. And but it was just, that was one of the best matches I've ever seen. I'd probably put that in the top five or so.
And there was this sense that perhaps Dimitrov had provided a blueprint for Federer. I remember, for sort of how to harm Nadal, because, you know, the comparison had been made for years between Dimitrov and Federer. But I remember thinking that I didn't think Federer could match what Dimitrov did physically in that match. That was what really struck me, the way Dimitrov lived with Nadal physically. And I think you saw the effort that was required by Nadal to win that match and his reaction at the end. I remember he collapsed to the ground, as kind of as though he'd won the tournament. It was a celebration of that scale, and I think that was just an illustration of the effort that Dimitrov had put in that night. So we've made it to to finals weekend. We've got the ninth Grand Slam final meeting between Serena and Venus, and the ninth Grand Slam final meeting between Federer and Nadal. Serena and Venus go first on the Saturday, and Serena beats Venus 6-4, 6-4 to overtake Steffi Graf's open era record. She wins her 23rd major title, gets back to world number one. Not a classic match, I think. You know, we know that Serena-Venus matches can sometimes be a little awkward. This I felt was almost sort of ceremonial, and sort of, I think people were just so happy to see them in the final again. I don't think people were too concerned about the quality of the match. That was my impression. I don't know how it felt on the grounds.
Yeah, that's a really good way of talking about it. It did have a slightly Community Shield vibe about it. that it was a sort of experiential thing rather than a results-based thing. And again, it's editorialising after the fact. But of course, we now know Serena Williams was two and a half months pregnant, I think, with her daughter. And Venus was one of the only people in the world that knew that. And look, we can all imagine and talk about what that dynamic must be like, but none of us can even get close to knowing what was going through their minds on that particular day. And of course, because we didn't know at the time, we've had no opportunity to ask them about it, and whether they would open up about it is another thing altogether. But I mean, we know that it's a very different dynamic for Venus as the protective older sister than it is for Serena. Serena's always, you know, going back to our first ever Tennis Relived episode, their first final in Miami, Serena's always had that slightly more competitive edge. So for Venus to be trying to beat not only her sister, but her niece or nephew as well, I can only imagine. And I suspect that's a part, at least, of why it had a slightly different feel about it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I feel like their matches generally, there's always going to be that element, the fact that we all know that they love each other to bits. And yes, they want to win the tennis matches, but they don't want to upset their opponent. If they can win and not upset their opponent, that's the ideal world. But even so, I mean, it still felt like a great big deal, really, to have these two in this final. It felt like one massive celebration, really, of their careers, of their achievement, of their family's success. And that was without us even knowing that Serena was pregnant. So what an additional story we would eventually get. But I think it's also worth remembering that Serena was still felt like the best player in the world. Generally, okay, she won the tournament, but it still felt like if she plays well, she wins the tournament. And Venus, this was out of the blue for her. It wasn't out of the blue for Serena.
Yeah, I mean, Venus, sort of looking at her run, she faced three opponents ranked outside the top 100 and another ranked 87. You know, the draw broke open for her, and she really took advantage of it and played some brilliant tennis, especially against Pavlyuchenko and Van der Weij. But of course, Serena was the best player in the world. She won the tournament without dropping a set. I did go back and have a look at the match. There were four straight breaks to start the match, and Serena actually smashed a racket in the third game. Maybe, I don't know, a sign of tension. There was a net cord that she didn't quite get up to, and sort of all in one movement, she sort of smashed her racket while trying to get to the ball. It was, she sort of styled it out. But I think what I remember about this occasion more than anything, and why I describe it as kind of a celebration of their rivalry and their relationship with each other, is because of the speeches that followed the final. I just think they perfectly sum up the relationship they have with each other. And obviously, as you've mentioned, Catherine, it would take on this extra special quality in the months that followed, as we found out about Serena's pregnancy and the fact that Venus was one of only five people who knew about it. So when you consider all that context and you hear these speeches, I just think it makes them extra special. So here they are.
Good evening in Australia. Hello around the world. I am so happy to be able to play in front of you all tonight and to thank you. Thank you to my team. Love you guys. Y'all rock. Serena Williams. That's my little sister, guys. Congratulations, Serena, on number 23. I have been right there with you. Some of them I lost right there against you. I guess that's weird, but it's true. And but it's been an awesome thing. Your win has always been my win. I think you know that. And all the times that I couldn't be there, wouldn't be there, didn't get there, you were there. I'm enormously proud of you. You mean the world to me. Sister Isha, where are you? Oh, dang, she didn't come. I get it. It's too hard. I get it. Isha, I love you. Lindrea, my sister, I love you. Mother, Dad, I love you guys. I, God willing, would love to come back. Thank you for all the love. Thank you. I really would like to take this moment to congratulate Venus. She's an amazing person. There's no way I would be at 23 without her. There's no way I would be at 1 without her. There's no way I would have anything without her. She's my inspiration. She's the only reason I'm standing here today and the only reason that the Williams sisters exist. So thank you, Venus, for inspiring me to be the best player that I could be and inspiring me to work hard. Every time you won this week, I felt like I got a win too. So thank you so much. Thank you. And she deserves an incredible round of applause. She's made an amazing comeback, and I definitely think she'll be standing here next year. And I don't like the word comeback. She's never left, so she's been such a great champion. So thank you, Venus.
Ah, lovely,
yes,
isn't it?
That's totally just put a smile on my face.
Says it all.
Yeah, in particular, Venus. Yeah. I love her saying, "That's my little sister." That's really nice. Magnus met his little sister today and it was a different reaction. Anyway, moving on.
I guess the final thing to say on this is throughout this whole episode and this whole look back on this tournament, I've been trying to figure out whether at the time I thought of this as a one-off or whether I thought it was going to be a building block for the season to come. And obviously in Venus's case, it very much did lead to a season where she reached the Wimbledon final, she reached the US Open semi-final, and I think those are two results which probably are the ones that got away a little bit more than this one for Venus, especially the US Open. But for Serena, obviously we found out in April that she was, I think, 20 weeks pregnant, and she had been pregnant during the Australian Open. So we didn't really find out whether Serena would go on to win more majors that season because she didn't play anymore. And I just think you can look back on this tournament now, a few years on, as really ushering in a new era for women's tennis. You think of the first-time Grand Slam champions that there have been since this moment. Ostapenko, Stevens, Wozniacki, Halep, Osaka, Barty, Andreescu, Kenin, and Świątek have all won slams for the first time since this moment. And, you know, this is kind of the last slam of Serena's real dominance. She might win another one, but I don't think she's going to dominate again like she was in this period.
It was a candidate for sliding doors, wasn't it? We didn't know if it would be slightly sort of weird or insensitive to do a, you know, if Serena Williams hadn't had a baby.
Yeah.
But it absolutely is a slight, because I certainly, you know, at the time would have thought, if you'd asked me, will Serena Williams win more slams this year, wouldn't have hesitated to say yes, at least one. So, the talk about 24 is put to bed. Everything has a slightly different complexion on it. So it is a sliding doors, definitely. We're very glad she did bring Olympia into the world. Lovely.
Yeah, because she's wonderful.
I
hadn't, when you reeled off all those names, Matt, who've won slam titles since then, yeah, that hadn't really occurred to me.
It's an extraordinary shift. Right.
And then
we are here. I don't really know what to say.
Well, let's say this. We spent about 2 hours watching it last night. Rafael Nadal against Roger Federer in the final of the Australian Open. And we watched the final set together, didn't we? And
I saw an expression on Matt's face, David. I don't know about you, that I don't think I've ever seen before. It was really... It was wondrous.
Yeah. Utter contentment and exhilaration.
Yeah.
He was just. And how many times have you seen
it's
that
like a
set,
kid,
Matt?
A lot. Kid being shown a Disney film for the first time.
Oh, I mean, I can't count the number of times I've watched that final set. I've watched it an awful lot. I mean, a lot. You know, very soon after it happened, I certainly had it on repeat for weeks and months after it happened. It sustained me through my year abroad. But yeah, it is a fantastic set of tennis. There's so many reasons why it's fantastic. The opening sets are compelling and they're high stakes and they're intense and you're very aware that history is on the line. But neither player is playing well at the same time. It's a sort of classic tennis problem, and it's therefore a bit patchy, those first four sets, I would say. I think I felt that at the time. I certainly think that looking back. But the fifth set is a masterpiece, and it stands up with any tennis I've ever really witnessed in terms of everything on the line, the tennis they both play, the atmosphere. The early stages of it feel extremely familiar in their rivalry because Federer is conjuring up magnificence after magnificence, yet he's not doing it on the break points. And Nadal is saving his best tennis for those biggest points. And he saves 5 out of 5 break points to start that final set.
Yeah, Federer's drawing gasps from us watching last night, 4 years on, and from the crowd. And yet he's a breakdown at the start of that set, which really says it all, I think. But I mean, when we consider everything that Andy Roddick said in that interview, it still stands up. Nadal is bringing his game. He is bringing what has dominated that rivalry to the court that night. And he's playing high intensity. He's executing for the most part. And yet Federer has found the answer on the night. I mean, watching it back, and it's the first time I've ever watched that final set because I wasn't commentating on it, and I got sort of trapped in a corridor outside the commentary box without any windows or anything. I won't bore you with all the technicalities, but anyway, that's where I was, so I didn't see any of it. But watching it last night was watching Federer just... his own defiance, his own, I don't care what you do, I am going to swat it away for a winner. Get out of my way. Get this ball out of my way. And that one. And hitting the living daylights out of it. And the thing that really struck me was how his, and I don't know all the technicalities, but how the backhand looked. This short, stabbing, bunting, flat-faced backhand that he just... smacked down the line or cross court repeatedly, and sometimes without a full flourish on it, just timing it off the high bouncing, spitting topspin forehand of Nadal, and just swishing it cross court. You know, it reminds me of how I think it was Jürgen Dess, a former ATP trainer, once told me how he'd got the strongest grip of any player in the top 50 back in Federer's teenage years, and yet he got this twig-like forearms, and you're trying to work out, well, how has he got this incredible grip strength? And I'm watching him hit this backhand, and you're seeing that grip strength on the ball. He's absorbing all of this power from this muscle man at the other end of the court, and yet he's taking charge of these rallies. It was Federer at his most majestic, I would say, that set of tennis.
He was consistently half-volleying ground strokes from the baseline. He did not give an inch. It looked like there was an electric fence six inches behind the baseline for preventing him from breaching that area. It really did. It was like a sort of training exercise in you're not allowed to cross this line. Extraordinary. Of course, we've seen him do that on the forehand side consistently throughout his career, but that's what Nadal's been able to do before this tournament, either push him back on that backhand or get him sort of hitting a defensive shot or an uncomfortable mistimed shot. But he just... the conviction in him to half volley the single-handed backhand. It did. It looked, and then get it into open up the court and just hit into it, opening the shoulders. It looked Wawrinka-esque or Wawrinka-esque. Wawrinka. Retroactively adjusting our pronunciation of Wawrinka is, I'm finding it really troublesome. It was Wawrinka-esque. Edit that if you like, Matt.
Yes, and I think one of the things we've seen through watching back quite a lot of old matches of Federer and Nadal is Federer feels like he has to go for a lot on his forehand because he can't hurt Nadal on the backhand. But in this match, he can. And it happens throughout the match, really, that Federer's got this newfound confidence in his backhand. I read at the time that Federer drove 87 of his 91 backhand returns in the match, and he only sliced back four of them. He completely put that shot away, which is Federer's bread and butter, the sort of chip, slice, backhand return. But he knows against Nadal that he gets hurt when he does that. And he had this confidence and this conviction and this ability to hit over the backhand. And it was serving him well throughout the match. But we get into that fifth set and Nadal, exactly as you said, David, has started to take control. He's starting to win the important points. He's in the lead. And then the reason why this match will always stand out is 3-1 down in the fifth set, Federer perfects his art, his craft, so urgently and so perfectly, and puts together five games of tennis that are five of the best games he's ever played. And he's got 10 years of history saying that he can't beat Nadal in Grand Slams. He hadn't beaten Nadal over five sets since 2007 at Wimbledon. All that history that he's playing against, and yet he perfects his game. And I just think it's this perfect exemplar of Federer's grace and his fighting spirit in tandem with one another. Because he gives that line after the match about how he would be happy to have a draw with Nadal. But Federer's eyes are saying something extremely different during those games. There's a ferocity in Federer's eyes, an intensity. And he goes out and he grabs that match. And it's something that is remarkable to witness him do that under all that pressure.
And Nadal's eyes, when he says that, are like, oh, for goodness sake, well, if you'd have been happy with a draw, This is wasted on you then, mate.
And his eyes are saying something different as well. His eyes are saying, yeah, right, mate. Of course. I mean, great. It's a fantastically sporting moment. We watched that ceremony together and the speeches afterwards. And Nadal just looks crestfallen, doesn't he? They're long, those ceremonies. They're really long. And there was a moment when he gets called up to speak, and you said, Catherine, it's like it's become a cathartic experience for him to talk now, because he started to lighten up talking to the crowd and thanking them, and realize, no, actually, this was a good fortnight, and this was a good day. But he was so upset, he wanted it so much, and it wasn't to be.
It was actually Matt that said that.
Was it?
Okay. I would have taken credit, but Matt's edited so many kind clips in for me that I will do the decent thing.
So this was Federer's third five-setter of the tournament. You know, all these worries about his physical state, and I think there were genuine concerns, but yet no man has ever won more five-setters en route to a Grand Slam title than three. That is kind of the maximum. He beat four top 10 players in the tournament. He was the first player since Mats Wilander in 1982 to beat that many top 10 players en route to winning a slam. Just so many little stats like that, which just showed how extraordinary this feat was of Federer's. Shall we end our journey through the 2017 Australian Open by hearing from Mary Crillo?
Oh, yes, please.
Here's Mary with the last word on this match and this tournament.
I said this as I was covering the 2017 Australian Open, that I had never been to a major that was full of so many tremendous storylines. Every bit of that was great. It was like traveling into the Wayback Machine, because all these great champions were showing us what they still had left, you know? And I loved the speed of the court in 2017. It had some real speed in it. It was great. Roger first, he'd had back issues, and then he'd had the knee issues, which had kept him out of that big chunk of 2016. So all of a sudden he looked younger than ever in Australia. And Nadal was amazing too. And I don't know if you were around for the only time Nadal won the Australian Open. He had to go through Roger in the championship match there. And remember when Roger was crying as he was getting his runner-up award. And Rafa was comforting him. Remember all that? Roger said, "This is killing me." We knew Roger was a crier. I mean, you know, we've seen that from him, you know. The guy's a softie. But here's Rafa needing to comfort him. So now, all these years later, they're playing for the championship. And it was a hell of a match. It was a hell of a match. And the thing is, when Rafa went up 3-1 in the fifth, didn't you think he was going to win? I thought he was going to win. And all of a sudden, Roger Federer, you know, of the early 2000s, like shows up again and wins the last five games of the match. Like without even blinking, it seemed. It was, and I believe Roger Federer when he said after that performance, there are no ties in tennis, but if there were, I would share this trophy with Rafa. I believed him when he said that. I think he would. I mean, that's what their friendship and that rivalry had become. They knew each other's greatness, you know? I think they enjoy going up against each other's strokes, maybe not on clay for Roger, but on any other surface, they really get to test one another to the fullest. And that's the kind of match that was. That 2017 Australian Open was exquisite through and through.
Well, if Mary's saying that, I take it back. They were perfectly happy to share it. but I do feel that they appreciate each other enormously, not just as players, but as people. I think that they do. They both love being in each other's company, just like McEnroe and Borg do. They're buzzing. And Chris Everton, Martina Navratilova, they love each other. You know, they really do. There's an enormous warmth between them. And if there's not another Grand Slam final between them, that one will do. You know, that 2017 will stand forever in the memory, I think.
Yeah. Mm. And of course it set up another 12 months where they dominated men's tennis. I think they won the next five slams between them. And actually that was something we commented on, wasn't it? Watching this match back, I think ESPN brought up a graphic that obviously Federer was on 18, Nadal was then on 14, and Djokovic was on 12 at the time. So to think that Nadal has actually won more Grand Slams since this final than Djokovic, I hadn't quite got my head around that. Yeah.
And somehow surprising.
Mm, it is surprising to me. I mean, he's obviously won four French Opens, but...
Yeah. But you kind of feel... I wouldn't have been at all surprised if that loss kind of defeated him a little bit or knocked the stuffing out of him, you know? And here he is, 4 years on, and he's won more of the slams than any of those other two, and he's now level with Federer. I mean, when you bear in mind again what Roddick had said, and I would have completely agreed with that, that 18 and 14, that feels like too big a gap. And here he is, they're both on, and Federer's won another two, even beyond that age. And it's still not enough. He can't put the guy away.
They are extraordinary, aren't they? Can we relive this again next week? No, we'll have actual tennis next week.
Yeah. I tell you what, Brett, brilliant job, Matt. Oh.
Yeah. Extraordinary.
If you're still listening to us after more than 2 hours, thank you for staying with us.
And a reminder that Matt did that research twice.
Yes, he did. I think he could have probably done it, just reeled it off out of off the top of his head, to be honest. But no, I actually loved listening to your contributions in that, Matt. It was so interesting because we didn't get to hear them at the time because you weren't with us back then as a podcast contributor on the show. And, well, you know, I don't want to embarrass you, but that just shows what you add to me. It's another example because I've just really enjoyed your take on it for the last 2 hours plus. And I hope you have as well. I hope everybody's enjoyed it because it's been an absolute treat for me. And yeah, we will be back on Monday. We're recording tonight at 10 p.m. Friday evening, our time in the UK.
Sorry, one last thing that I've forgotten to say. I can't believe we've got this far. We're recording on the 29th of January. 29th of January is the date of the Federer and Nadal match at the Australian Open.
Things have changed a bit, haven't they? Jeez. Yeah. Oh, dear. But, you know, we're still chatting and I'm still having a pint.
Yeah, it might not be the 29th of January by the time this is uploaded.
No.
It's a long edit ahead.
Yeah, indeed. But that's how much he loves it. He gets to listen to it all again. Not to worry. And yes, we will have live tennis to talk about on Monday. And my word, will we? God, there'll be too much tennis. It'll be all a bit discombobulating.
The Crocodile Dundee and the Crocodile Dundee 2 trophies.
They've come up with another one
next week. Well, yeah, and it's not called the Crocodile Dundee, even though I gave them that idea for free.
Yeah.
They've thrown it back in my face.
There's going to be tennis tournaments everywhere. There's 3 WTA events next week. How many ATP events are there? 2 of those? So there's
2 plus the ATP Cup.
Plus the ATP Cup. So there's 6 events to keep across next week. Brilliant. So we'll have that to talk about on Monday. We'll also have the Australian Open draw to look forward to later on next week. If you're enjoying the tennis podcast, do tell people you know and get them listening because we want to spread the word as much as we can and maybe they'll enjoy it as well. We've got a few little bits of business to just remind you about as well. We have our own mascots. I have Rogue, who is an exceptional cat. Catherine has who, Catherine?
Zeus.
Zeus. What a name. Zeus the dog.
Name does the talking.
Yeah.
And I have received an email while we're recording this podcast with some more photos of Zeus. Nicolas is back with him. I think they've been separated for a number of months.
Nicolas.
Travel restrictions and everything. So yes, they've been reunited and we have new photos of Zeus, which is brilliant.
Billie Jean bounded up to German Shepherd in the park yesterday. I mean, I was thinking that's the equivalent of sort of me bounding up to like that snowman at the end of Ghostbusters in terms of size difference, relative size difference. She was desperate to be friends. I mean, the Alsatian wasn't really, give me an equivalent. There's no animal that big.
That's amazing.
Well, what would you have come up with?
Not that. That's so good. Scousel Mousel, right, Matt?
Yes, Scousel Mousel.
Your magnificent pet mascot. We'd like to say hello to Cookie, by the way. Cookie, who's been a really top draw pet mascot for this week's series of Tennis Relived shows. Have we got some shout-outs, Matt?
Hey, what? Cookie's a Venus Williams fan.
Oh, yeah, Cookie. Good on you. Venus Williams fan.
Yes. This is her show.
Hey.
And yes, we do have shout outs for Andy Yu.
Hey, Andy. Andy's often in touch with us on Twitter and on social media.
Well,
and
Andy Me.
Well, no,
Andy
very
Me
good.
Or Andy Yu?
Oh, dear. Sorry about that, Andy. Don't worry about it. Andy's a nice bloke. He's always in touch. And very, very enthusiastic listener. So good on you, mate.
Oh, excellent. Connie Simon.
Hi, Connie.
Ooh, like Paul Simon.
Indeed. Briggs. Solid home.
Yeah, all the famous ones. Yeah. Paul Solihull, Connie.
Thanks for your support, Connie.
He's on Twitter, Solihull Simon, if anyone wants to follow him.
That. I said that last time.
And finally, a shout out for Kathleen Sharkey.
Kathleen.
Oh, come on.
That's a good name.
That's really snazzy.
That's the best name. Oh, Kathleen.
Kathleen, almost the perfect name, but still, you know, great.
Mm. Right.
Oh, it's a lot like Catherine, isn't it?
And like the one in Romancing the Stone, Kathleen Turner.
Is that Kathleen Turner? Yeah. Great actress, yeah. Sharky. Oh, I'd love to be called Sharky.
Oh, too bad. It's been taken.
Yeah.
So there we are. Thank you all for your support. That's, you know, that's the important bit, really. We're just hugely grateful to everybody who's shown us the support that they have. And to you for listening. We really appreciate it. We really hope you're enjoying these series of shows. And we'll be back big time next week with live tennis to talk about. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.